In her autobiography, Ida B. Wells once wrote, quote, "One had better die fighting against injustice than to die like a dog or a rat in a trap." That sentiment has outlived Wells through the work of activists, but so has the need to fight against systemic racism. Today, we're reflecting on the life of a pioneering Black journalist whose contributions have touched nearly every facet of American life. With us to talk about it is someone with closer ties to Ida B. Wells than your average researcher, Michelle Duster. She's Wells' great-granddaughter and the author of a new biography called Ida B. the Queen, The Extraordinary Life and Legacy of Ida B. Wells. And she joins us now from Chicago. Michelle, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Jen.
Well, for people who aren't familiar with Ida B. Wells, can you just give us a brief sense of her story?
So my great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells, was born into slavery in 1862 in Holly Springs, Mississippi. She was orphaned at the age of 16, and she started her career as a teacher to take care of her younger siblings. She eventually moved to Memphis, where she started. That's where she started her activism and journalism. And after she suffered a great loss that propelled her into being a civil rights activist, she moved to New York City, traveled around England and United Kingdom to tell the story about lynching. And she eventually got involved in the suffrage movement. And after she moved to Chicago, she was involved in social work. Mm-hmm.
You write in the biography that growing up, your father and grandmother, quote, de-emphasized the larger-than-life legacy we were born into and encouraged us to develop our own interests and skills. What was it like for you later in life to do this really wonderful excavation of her life and work?
I think once I became an adult and I was closer to the age that Ida was when she was doing some of her work, is when it resonated with me the extent of the achievement that she had. Once I entered the workforce and started having my own experiences, then I started thinking, wow, you know, what did my great-grandmother, deal with when she was around the same age? So it took a while for me to really appreciate the massive level of achievement that she had at such a young, at now what is considered a young age.
Yeah. You write about how in your mid-30s, your path began to align with hers. How did learning more about her shape your identity as a Black woman, but also the career path you found yourself on?
Well, I honestly did not make a deliberate choice to follow in my great-grandmother's footsteps. I was just following my own personal interests. And I think other people looked at it as me following in her footsteps. But maybe just because of the way I was raised and just my own personal interests, I really cared and still care about how Black people are portrayed in the media. I think that the media images are very powerful in shaping not only attitudes, but policy because of attitudes. And so I really want to be involved in participating in creating more positive and well-rounded images of Black people.
We got this tweet from Clinton who says, "I see Ida B. Wells as one of the investigative journalists whose work exposed the brutality and extrajudicial nature of lynchings and the ideological machinery of the mainstream white press that failed to report those atrocities accurately or hold officials accountable." Michelle, you start the biography with an FBI report on Ida, who was surveilled throughout her life, and the report identified her as, quote, "one of the most dangerous Negro agitators." What was going on in her life at that time? Why was she being tracked?
Well, Jen, at that time, that was during World War I, and there was a major race riot that took place in Houston as a result of some soldiers that were stationed at Camp Logan. And the soldiers were actually killed by the United States government. There were several that were hanged and then several that were sentenced to long prison sentences. And so my great-grandmother at the time felt that was an outrage for the government of soldiers who were being trained to fight for freedom and democracy overseas. did not receive justice in their own country. And her protest was framed to her as treason.
And what was her response?
She didn't seem to be intimidated at all by that potential, kind of charge, because all she was doing was she created some buttons that said "Murdered Negro Soldiers," and she wanted to have some kind of a ceremony or service to honor them. And so I guess her attitude was like, well, if you want to arrest me for making buttons, then, you know, go ahead. I dare you. She didn't seem to be intimidated by that at all. And obviously she was not arrested and she was not charged. And I'm not even sure if she knew that a file had been created and she was being watched. But she, I can only get, you know, go by what she wrote. She didn't seem to be intimidated at all.
Mm. You put such detail into this biography, and just talk us through the process of, you know, really excavating the life of this woman who is well known to so many, but to whom you have this very personal connection.
I think because I am related to Ida B. Wells, and she is a public figure, a historical icon, I do have a unique relationship because my grandmother was Ida's youngest daughter, and I spent a lot of time with my grandmother. I am one of 15 grandchildren, so I'm not the only one with this experience, but I think out of my cousins and I probably had the most curiosity, and I also had the most interest in writing and working in communications. And as a result, I ended up working on a documentary film about Ida by William Greaves, Ida B. Wells, A Passion for Justice, which was a part of the American Experience series in the 1980s. And so I had the most exposure to scholars, and I had the experience of being in spaces that were connected to Ida's life in Memphis. I also have been down to Holly Springs, Mississippi. So I think those kind of experiences helped me become more connected, I guess, to her life story. And as far as my relationship to her, I think I view her in a different way than maybe most people do. I'm kind of drawn to things about her as far as her, for instance, her business acumen. I find that to be fascinating, and most people don't think of her as a businesswoman.
And talk about that a little bit more, because one of the things that's fascinating is the way she built opportunities for herself and for other people.
Right. Well, one example that I found to be genius on her part was she was asked to go on a 4-month speaking tour to England to talk to the British about what was going on regarding lynching, and they offered to pay for her travel and expenses, but no pay, you know, for her. Mm-hmm. And so she decided to approach the Daily Interocean newspaper in Chicago, and I guess pitched the idea of writing a column called Ida Abroad for her to get paid. So she was kind of like a foreign correspondent. And so that's how she ended up making some kind of income while she was traveling around for several months in England. And I just am fascinated by the fact that she realized she needed to actually make a living and figured out a way to create an opportunity for herself. And I'm so glad she did, because now that left behind a series of newspaper articles that she wrote from England. And I actually compiled those into a different book in 2010.
What did she write about?
I mean, it was kind of like a travel log where she wrote about the different people that she was meeting, the speaking engagements that she had, the the reaction that the British had to her work, to the message that she was giving. And some of the things were really funny to me to read, where she was kind of describing the food and like her experience riding on the trains and things like that. So it's very, her writing is very descriptive. And so you almost feel like you're traveling with her.
Well, last August, you wrote a piece for Time magazine titled, "I'm Ida B. Wells' Great Granddaughter, and I'm Still Fighting Her Fight for the Vote." Tell us more about her work as a suffragist and what the fight for voter access looks like today from your view.
Well, my great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells, was involved in the suffrage movement. She was very active in Chicago with a couple of different organizations that were predominantly white. But then in 1913, she decided to found her own organization that was for more focused on black women. It was the Alpha Suffrage Club. And shortly after that, just a couple of months later, she was one of, she represented the Alpha Suffrage Club at the march in Washington, the suffrage march in Washington, D.C. And so as far as I know, she was the only black woman that went with the Illinois delegation. And once she arrived, once the whole delegation arrived, black women were asked to march in the back of the parade. And there's there was some controversy within the Illinois delegation about if they wanted to comply with that. Ultimately, what happened was that Ida, I guess, in my opinion, pretended to agree. And then the day of the march, she couldn't be found and ultimately inserted herself front and center of the Illinois delegation. So she famously integrated the parade. And once she came back to Chicago, she the Alpha Suffrage Club was very active in canvassing the neighborhood to help Oscar de Priest become elected as the first African-American alderman in Chicago. So he won in 1914, was installed in 1915, and that put the Alpha Suffrage Club and black women, as far as political, politically engaged women and the active voters, to be considered a powerful bloc and a powerful entity within the political system. As far as how it...
Let's pause for one moment. We're talking about the legacy of Ida B. Wells with her great-granddaughter, Michelle Duster. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from her and from you in just a moment. Now let's get back to the legacy of Ida B. Wells with Michelle Duster. She's Wells' great-granddaughter, and she's also the author of a new biography called Ida B. the Queen. And I want to bring one more voice into the conversation. Joining us now is Nicole Hannah-Jones. She's a reporter for the New York Times Magazine. She's also the co-founder of the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting out of UNC Chapel Hill. Nicole, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we want to hear from you, too, about how Ida B. Wells' legacy has shaped your life. You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. And here's a voicemail one of you left for us. And this is what you had to say about the impact of Ida B. Wells in your life.
This is Mary C. Curtis, journalist in Charlotte, North Carolina. Ida B. Wells is my inspiration. I became interested in news when I watched my older siblings in the civil rights movement plan and strategize. And then I learned that that meant I was to be a journalist telling stories. I was drawn to Ida B. Wells's life and work. She was fearless and strong. And you look at her photos, so beautiful, so unstoppable.
Mary, thanks for that message. Michelle, Ida is perhaps best known for her investigative journalism, and that included documenting lynching across the United States. That began when one of her own friends was lynched in Memphis in the 1890s. Can you tell us that story?
Right. Well, my great-grandmother had three friends. I think she knew the other guys, Thomas Moss, Calvin Stewart, and William Stewart and Calvin McDowell. And they owned a grocery store that rivaled a white-owned grocery store. And basically, the owner of the white-owned grocery store decided to eliminate the competition by eliminating them, meaning that they were murdered, they were lynched. And that opened my great-grandmother's eyes to the fact that lynching was being used as a tool for domestic terrorism, and it was a backlash against Black progress, and it was also used as a way to oppress and terrorize the Black community. So she started investigating other lynchings to see how many other innocent people were being killed, and that led to her life being threatened, and she was ultimately exiled from the South. And she continued speaking out once she was in the northern part of the country.
Nicole, in your view, what's been the impact of Ida B. Wells' investigative journalism on the field?
Well, even though she often doesn't get the credit, Ida B. Wells innovated certain reporting techniques that we still use. She was one of the early data reporters. At the time when Ida B. Wells started investigating lynching, we really had no catalog of how many people were being lynched, what were the reasons given for the lynchings, what were the actual reasons of the lynchings. So she began to compile data and giving us a count of how many lynchings were occurring. Of course, now we use data journalism all of the time. So she was really an innovator of investigative reporting techniques. And it's time that we kind of give her the credit for that.
What does her legacy mean to you personally?
It's hard for me to even put into words what Ida B. Wells' legacy means to me. I'll never forget when I came across her autobiography and read this book about a woman who had been born into slavery, who lived through Reconstruction, who was a fierce advocate for civil rights, for human rights, for women's rights, a suffragist, a feminist, all of those things that women were still fighting against. Now, she was fighting against at a time when women didn't have the right to vote, when Black people had gotten the legal right to vote, but were having that vote violently suppressed. And here was a woman willing to stand for all of those things. So personally, she still provides a model of the fearless, unflinching type of journalism that I am trying to do, and the courage to do the type of journalism that many powerful people don't want done, to challenge mainstream narratives. Of course, the mainstream narrative about lynchings was that Black men were rapacious and brutes who needed to be lynched. And she was willing to challenge that public narrative and really change the way that our society understood why lynchings were happening, and turned anti-lynching into a global crusade. So in every way, I've long been an admirer of her. I've studied her journalism. I've studied her writing. And that's the reason we wanted to name the Ida B. Wells Society after her. We thought it was important to show, even though you don't see the field of investigative reporting being reflective of the percentage of Black people who live in the population, that we actually have a very long legacy of investigative reporting. And she is one of the greatest contributors to the field.
Michelle, in reading your biography, what really stood out for me was the way it was important to Ida B. Wells, not just to move in circles of power, to, you know, speak to a president, but to also remain rooted in and connected to her community. Can you talk about what she did at the community level to help the people who lived around her?
Right. Well, that's one of the things about my great-grandmother, Ida B. Wells, that I think makes her, I mean, she was extraordinary in so many ways, but to me, that also made her a little different, stand out from some other people then and now, because she interacted with people who were the presidents of the United States and to prisoners and everything in between. So she straddled social classes. And so she actually became a parole officer and, you know, and interacted with people who were imprisoned or right out of prison and advocated for their for them to receive justice. So, I mean, one of the famous incidents was when she went to Little Rock, Arkansas, and visited the prisoner, the people who were in prison, the sharecroppers who had stood up for themselves in Elaine, Arkansas. They were trying to form a union and were retaliated against. And then, of course, they were considered the aggressors and so were arrested. And she advocated for them, for their innocence. And there are several other people that she mentions in her autobiography that she fought for their for them to receive justice.
We're talking with Michelle Duster, the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells. She's the author of a new biography called Ida B. the Queen. Also with us, Nicole Hannah-Jones. She's a reporter for the New York Times Magazine. She's also the co-founder of the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting out of UNC Chapel Hill. Nicole, can you tell us a bit more about the work you do as part of the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting?
Sure. I think it's important first to say why investigative reporting matters. Investigative reporting is the reporting that holds powerful people accountable. It is the one that exposes the way that power is wielded against the vulnerable. It is the way that exposes things that people who have power don't want known. And so it is critical that that field be reflective of the people in this country, because what that means, it is also, because of the hierarchy of journalism, the whitest aspect of journalism, because this is the most prominent aspect of journalism. If you don't have people of color in those positions, they are simply stories and investigations that never occur. And myself and my co-founders had to fight really hard to become investigative reporters. It wasn't something that our newsrooms invested in us becoming. It wasn't how people saw us. And we didn't see very many examples in the field of Black investigative reporters. So we decided to create an organization to really eliminate the most common refrain we hear when we lamented about how non-diverse the field was, which was we would hear again and again, oh, we would love to diversify, but we just can't find anyone qualified. Well, we certainly knew that that wasn't true. But we also realized that oftentimes journalists don't get the proper supports and training and mentorship to move into the field of investigative reporting. So we created this organization to really address that need, to at once offer training and support for journalists who want to do this type of work, but also to be able to answer to news organizations when they say they're looking for someone and can't find someone, that we know they're qualified people because we have trained them ourselves.
Michelle, in your research for this book, I know it was a mixture of you know, the research you would do when you're researching any individual, but you also had access to people who knew your great-grandmother personally. And I'm curious what you learned about what drove her.
Well, actually, while I was working on this book and most of the work that I've done about my great-grandmother, I have done after my grandmother and her sister passed away. So that left a void of people who actually knew my great-grandmother personally. So most of the information that I've been able to gather has been through research that would, you know, anybody would have had to have done. I mean, the only insight that I have that's different is my grandmother. I think when I was growing up, she really more focused on the values that had been passed down in our family from her mother, which were, you know, that our voices are important, that we should not be intimidated by anybody, that we need to believe that we deserve to be anywhere that we want to be. and so, you know, those type of messaging was very strong in my family. Also, the strong emphasis on education and the idea that nobody can take away whatever you have inside of your head. And so you need to be as qualified as possible, as prepared as possible, and nobody can say that you are not qualified for something unless it's a different reason than what your credentials are.
Now, you've been part of several public history projects designed to honor Ida B. Wells, including renaming a major street in downtown Chicago to Ida B. Wells Drive. That was unveiled last year. Fortunately, it happened before I left Chicago, so I was able to drive that street quite a bit on my way to and from work before I left. But what did it take to make something like that happen, especially given, I would assume, some fair amount of pushback?
Right, right. To have the Congress Parkway changed to Ida B. Wells Drive was definitely a great achievement. I have to give the League of Women Voters a lot of credit because they worked very hard to gain support from multiple stakeholders. And so there are politicians, there are grassroots organizations, there's a lot of advocacy that goes into making something like this happen. And I also want to mention that I've been working on an Ida B. Wells Monument project for 13 years now. And Nicole Hannah-Jones was extremely helpful in helping to raise the money for the project. So, you know, these things take more than just a few people to make these things happen. It takes a community.
Nicole, this is something you alluded to. You know, we're in this time when mainstream media outlets are still disproportionately white. To your mind, what do you think needs to happen for newsrooms to better reflect America?
I mean, the answer to that is simple. They need to hire and retain journalists that actually reflect America. I think we keep hearing a lot of excuses, and you have these moments where there's a nod towards a reckoning or realization that, oh, race is still a salient issue in this country that needs coverage. But then we just see a lot of hand-wringing. We don't see newspapers, radio stations really doing what it takes to hire and support journalists of color. And oftentimes they'll have these little hiring sprees, but they're losing as many people because they're not supporting those journalists once they get into the institutions as they should. I'll also say, I think it is really critical to understand hiring journalists of color, of course, changes the coverage and makes the coverage more accurate. It is more reflective of communities. It is, I would say, even more objective if one were to believe in objectivity. But covering racial inequality also requires a particular expertise. You wouldn't expect a science writer not to have studied science. So you shouldn't expect people who are tasked with writing about the history of race, how racial inequality plays out in our society today, who haven't studied that. And yet that is often the case. We don't treat race as an expertise, but it is.
Michelle, you've spent much of your career documenting and celebrating African-American history, particularly notable Black women. What's next for you?
Oh, wow. Well, I have a couple of projects. I'm actually have written two children's picture books, which will be published in 2022. But I'm also working on a couple of public history projects. One is a mural, a suffragist mural to celebrate Illinois suffragists. And I also have goals. I would love to have a suffrage monument dedicated for suffragists and political trailblazers in Illinois celebrate it. And there are a few other projects I want to get involved in that also celebrate and uplift and feature, you know, Black women and the contributions that Black people have made. And one other thing is I'm working on a children's book. I'm co-writing a children's book about a little boy who takes a road trip with his grandmother and he learns about Black history that way.
That's Michelle Duster, the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells. She's also the author of a new biography called Ida B. the Queen. Also with us, Nicole Hannah-Jones, a reporter for the New York Times Magazine. She's also the co-founder of the Ida B. Wells Society. Michelle, Nicole, it was a pleasure. Today's producer was Catherine Fink. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.